The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
There's sort of a permanent Advent quality to the Christian life. Adventus, the coming of the Lord. He came in time, that's true, and he's coming into our hearts now, but also we're longing for his coming at the end of time. That means all of Christian history, now over 2,000 years is going to go on, who knows how much longer. There's always a vigil quality to it. We're waiting. We're watching. There's something unfulfilled about this life. We want something we don't fully have. And I think the Advent season calls all this to mind, brings all this to consciousness.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, those were a few words from our friend Bishop Robert Barron about the beginning of Advent season, which began yesterday. And I should say to you, not just I hope you had a happy Thanksgiving, but I want to wish you a happy new year. And you're like, what? It's not January 1st, Drew. It's not even December 1st. Yeah, but yesterday, guess what? We started the new liturgical year, right? The first Sunday of Advent. We are in Advent already. This has been one of the fastest years of my life. I don't know about you. I can think back to January like it was last month, you know, and here we are knocking on Christmas, and soon we're going to be into a whole new year again. Time flies. You know, Advent, the word comes from the Latin Adventus, which means, coming, and we're preparing for the coming of the Lord, not just as Christians, but also, as a lot of the saints have pointed out, right, we want him to come into our own hearts, and we need to be in union with him. We also need to be prepared for a second coming at the end of time. I'd love to talk to you about that one day. I think it's fascinating. It really is a great conversation. Coming up in a little bit, Father Richard Simon is going to be stopping by. He'd be great to talk to you about that. Because not only has there been, Faustina had been given revelations regarding this, the seers in Kibeho, Rwanda, this is the anniversary, the end of the 40th year of the anniversary in Kibeho, Rwanda. So we're now beginning the 41st year. That's one of the most prophetic apparition sites I know of. Met with some formal church approval. And I'll tell you more about it coming up. It's where the great genocide took place. That was predicted, where Father Ubald had come from, and Immaculate Ilabi Giza, New York Times bestselling author of the book Left to Tell. Fascinating series of apparitions where the Mother of God appeared. So I'll fill you in on that more, maybe a little bit later. I think you'll find it fascinating. I was there, actually, in the jungles of Africa for the very last appearance of the Mother of God to those seers. And I'll tell you what happened that day. It was pretty amazing. Thanksgiving. I hope you had a good one. I shared a Thanksgiving miracle the day before Thanksgiving with you. And then I saw a headline that got my attention. It said Thanksgiving Day miracle. I'm like, oh, let me read that. What's that all about, right? I opened the article, and it's the story of a man who fell from a cruise ship in the Gulf of Mexico, right? After a bathroom break, his sister had been at the bar, and she noticed he wasn't around anymore. And I don't know if you've ever been on a cruise. I mean, at night it is incredibly dark, and that cruise ship is moving. Imagine falling over, right, in the icy cold waters there, maybe shark infested, who knows? And you got to tread water. This guy tread water for 15 hours, right? 15 hours. Trying to find him, it had to be like a needle in a haystack. So the U.S. Coast Guard, of course, my hat's off to them. They made a very dramatic rescue. You talk about a miracle. And they pulled this man to safety hours after he fell overboard. Here's a little bit more from Fox Houston.
And a dramatic rescue captured on camera in the Gulf of Mexico. The U.S. Coast Guard pulls a man to safety hours after he fell from a cruise ship that set out from New Orleans on Thanksgiving Eve.
What makes the survival of this passenger so miraculous and so unlikely is that no one reported seeing him fall in, so it was not even known that he had gone overboard until the next afternoon. And yet, he was spotted, keeping himself afloat in the dark waters of the Gulf. It's believed that the man had been treading water for up to 21 hours at that point. The Coast Guard rushed in to organize the rescue after a cargo ship, aware of the search, spotted the man about 20 miles from the mouth of the Mississippi River. He was then hoisted to safety. In a statement, the Coast Guard Rescue Mission Coordinator for the New Orleans sector shared this. Quote, it took a total team effort from Coast Guard watchstanders, response crews, and our professional maritime partners operating in the Gulf of Mexico to locate the missing individual and get him to safety. First responders say the man, who has not been identified, was exhibiting hypothermic-like symptoms but was clearly responsive. They are calling the outcome a miracle. According to the AP, he was last seen by his sister around 11 p.m. the night before when he left the cruise ship bar. She reported her brother missing when it was clear that he did not make it back to his stateroom. 6 hours later, just before 8:30 p.m. on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, the rescue was made.
Yeah, you know, you leave the bar. Maybe he had a cocktail or two, right? I don't know. I mean, how do you explain falling off a cruise ship, right? How do you do that, right? Maybe he was looking over the railing and maybe, I don't know, maybe lost his balance, maybe passed that. Who knows? All I know is he plummeted into those dark waters of the Gulf, as they pointed out. And again, the cruise ship is just chugging away. Nobody knows where you are, when you fell in. There are currents and tides pulling you. The fact that this man has been found is a miracle. I mean, that is an absolute miracle. Nothing but dark. You don't have a life vest on. There's no flashing, you know, little light on it. Your cell phone's certainly not going to work, even if you had it on you, right? And you got to tread water. I thought it was 15 hours. You know, he tread water for almost a full day. Think about that, a full day. You jump into a pool and try treading water for 5 or 10 minutes, right? You're like, okay, I'm kind of done now, right? Try doing that for not 5 or 10 hours. But 21 hours. I mean, just put it into perspective. I mean, that really is a miracle. Maggie was saying to me before we came into the studio, she says, you know, that man had to have been praying for a miracle. And Maggie, you're right. There are no atheists in foxholes. And I believe me, there are no atheists in the middle of the Gulf, in the middle of the night, when you know that if you stop treading water, you're done. Then who knows what else is out there, right? Hey, speaking of, you know, weird events, how about Buffalo? How's that for a transition, right? If you live in the Buffalo region, I've been tracking these storms. I'd lived in the frozen tundra in Green Bay for years. And I remember one April, my wife had gone back to be with her sister and her aunt or whatever. There was some party she had to go to, and I had to work. I couldn't go. And she sends me a text or an image. She's in the backyard. You know, my brother-in-law's in a T-shirt. They're grilling up. You know, it's beautiful April day in Delaware. Well, meanwhile, I'm in Green Bay, Wisconsin, right? And we had the worst storm since 1885 in over 100 and some years. Over 3 feet of snow fell in just a period of about 2 days over the weekend. It was a Friday, and it just kept falling and falling. I remember looking out my window as the snow continued to rise. I tried to get out to open the driveway, but if I had a heart attack, I would have been dead. There was no way anybody could have came to get me, and there's no way I could have gotten out. But meanwhile, on the other side of the country, there she is in this balmy, beautiful weather. Well, Buffalo, they're under a lot of snow right now. In fact, it may be a record setting snowfall. I don't know if you have been following the story. Snow fell between Thursday, the 17th, and Sunday, the 20th, with most towns in the area. Check this out. How tall are you? 4 feet, 5 feet, 6 feet, right? They had 50 inches of snow. That's over 4 feet. Imagine how high that comes up to you, right? There were, however, some localities that had 80 inches. 80 inches. That's almost 7 feet of snow. That would bury me, right? It'd bury you. The storm may break New York's 24-hour snowfall record, as well as an unofficial 48-hour record. So a lot going on there. And speaking of weather, Hawaii, have you heard about this as well? We've got the opposite going on. Hawaii News is now reporting that scientists at the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory said that there was an eruption of a volcano there about 11:30 p.m. This volcano has first time it's gone off since in 38 years. So this is the world's largest active volcano, and it started erupting at the state's Volcanoes National Park Sunday night. Here's just a little bit of more info for you. Check this out.
In Hawaii, residents are under a falling ash advisory after the world's largest active volcano started erupting at the state's Volcanoes National Park. Mauna Loa started spewing lava on Sunday night for the first time in about 40 years. The National Weather Service in Honolulu says the ash fall could reach up to a quarter of an inch on some parts of the island.
And because of that, officials are advising folks with respiratory issues to stay inside. They're also warning about potential harm to crops and animals as well.
It's so weird. I was talking to a friend of mine on the way into the studio, And we were talking about Kibeho and how it predicted, you know, the genocide that would follow and these strange new viruses and diseases. Maria Esperanza, the mystic from South America, spoke about the same thing. And I think of Matthew, the Gospel of, I think it's Matthew 24, Matthew 25, I'm not quite sure which verse it was, where there's talk of wars and rumors of wars and how the earth will shake, right? And how we'll see these signs in the sky. We're seeing these strange events, you know, in the heavens, you know, race by. We're seeing volcanoes go off. We're seeing drought, mega drought in our own country here on the western side of the country. We're seeing strange viruses and diseases. We just dealt with a plague, right? A pandemic. This is crazy. I see these little tidbits. I don't want to read too much into them. I mean, the earth has always rumbled and shook, right? It's always been disease. But I also take a look, and I was saying this to Maggie before I walked into the studio. I said, you know, we live in an atheistic country, a regime, if you will, that is anti-family and anti-life, anti-God, right? And it harkens back to Sister Lucia, where she talked about how the final confrontation will be over just those issues. Why? Because you're a son and daughter of God. And Satan hates you. But more than anything, Satan hates the children of God. I think that's why there's this direct attack on family. I think that as a result of that, there's an attack on life in the womb, and there's an attack on life at the end of one's journey as well. So you just see the hallmarks of it. And I wonder where we are, just the timeline thing. How much longer can this type of rejection in God, in the embracement of sin, destruction of life, attack on marriage, you know, redefinition of gender, and all the things that come forth from God and his law, right? The way he created us and the way we were intended to be. How can we get so twisted? You know, how can we get so lost, so disoriented? I don't know. Things will have to be set right. But, you know, when I see these things, I just pray all the more. And I encourage you to do the same thing. I want to tell you about the Pope coming up here too. And Easter. You know, Father Simon, who's joined me regularly, he's going to be with me in about a minute or two here. Before I tell you what the Holy Father's saying about the new date for Easter, you got to listen to this. It's going to be a big story. I just want to share one other story on Dr. Fauci that has come across my radar here. You know, he's gotten a lot of praise, right? He's gotten it from media outlets all over. He's now on the hot seat. He's had to face questioning in a couple of lawsuits, including one that was brought by one of the regular guests, and he'll join us later in the week, Dr. Aaron Cariotti from the University of California, Irvine. He used to be from there. He got let go because he refused to get vaccinated. The depositions are revealing a lot of things, including the fact that Dr. Anthony Fauci emailed a friend in February of 2020. So go back 2 years, right? Guess what he said? He said to his friend, it was a female friend, he advised her that masks are ineffective. Right? They're ineffective. I even saw a video of him saying this in an interview, right? He confirmed that again a month later, right? Then the three-day, you know, then of course he changed his position, right? It was kind of the talking points of the administration and everybody had to be masked, your kid had to be masked. 3 days after that email, he adamantly stated masks should be worn, even though he couldn't cite a single study to prove it. Why? I don't know. On top of that, he relied on the advice of one person who'd gone to Wuhan, China, to look at their response to the COVID outbreak, which was, of course, lockdown. And we're seeing that today. I'll talk about that coming up a little bit later. But this person came back. He told Fauci that they were working, even though the World Health Organization, they had a delegation who said they could not, you know, independently verify that information. So as a lawyer for the plaintiff in the lawsuit, this is what this lawyer said. He said Fauci was apparently willingly to base his lockdown advocacy on observations of one single guy relying on reports from a dictator. And you've seen what happened in our country as a result of that, right? Now, you may disagree with me on this, but if you look at the data, we see where our kids are in terms of their learning levels. We see what it has done to business. We saw what it did to alcoholism and drug use. We saw what it did to suicide, right? We saw it with even the divorce. You know, you think people would grow closer during this time. We'll talk more about it coming up after the chapel today. In fact, I'll fill you in on what's going on China because there are riots going on there, right? Protest right now. So people are tired of being locked down. So a lot happening there. Let's talk Easter for a minute. You know, I've always marveled about the fact that this phenomena of the holy fire on Easter Saturday, or Holy Saturday of the Orthodox, on the Orthodox calendar, a blue flame emanates from the tomb of Jesus Christ, from the very slab where he was laid. And the patriarch goes in there, and he's got some unlit candles. They they light based on this miraculous blue flame that emanates from this slab. And then he goes out and the entire sepulcher gets lit up. I was just there in Israel a month or two ago. I asked one of the tour guides about it. And he said, no, Drew, it happens. I was here and I witnessed this. So I've always said to Father Simon, what's the deal, right? I mean, what's that say about the Orthodox calendar versus us? You know, one of the results of the division between Catholic and Orthodox churches has been that we have this common date for Easter, right? We've not had a common date, I really should say, ever since the invention of the Gregorian calendar. I think they're still in the Julian calendar. And astronomers in the 15th, 16th centuries noticed that the Julian calendar wasn't keeping up with the Earth's orbit around the sun. And the Julian calendar assumed that the Earth orbited, I think it was like 365.25 days, when it's actually slightly less than that. It's 24.2425, if you want to be literal. But so the Julian had a leap year every 4 years. The Gregorian calendar has a more complicated formula, where we have to, you know, we have leap years, which don't include century years, except for, I won't go down this path. It's too convoluted. Bottom line is, look, we got two different Easter dates, right? Pope Gregory, I think it was the 13th, ordered a new calendar to be made to correct the problem with the way things were working. So now Pope Francis and the Orthodox leaders are starting talks on this because we have two separate dates. In fact, Pope Francis told the Orthodox Patriarch, we're ready, right? We'll accept any proposal that's made together. So I'm joined today by Father Richard Simon. You know him. He's the great host of the show that precedes me. If you haven't had a chance to check out, you know, Father Simon Says, check him out, all right? I want to call him Father Know-It-All. He writes a blog called Father Know-It-All. That's why we tap into him and his genius. People do the same. So check out Father Simon Says right here on Relevant Radio, 1 hour before the Drew Mariani Show. Father, good to have you with me. Good afternoon.
Yeah, here I am, me and my genius.
Yes. I love it. No. Hey, you know, you and I have been talking about Holy Saturday forever.
Fire.
And
forever
I'm always like,
and ever.
Why isn't the Roman Catholic Church? Why aren't we in sync? Bring us back. Give us a little history as to why we have the split, and then ultimately Holy Father's saying.
Oh, dear. It's very hard to, you know, the split, there's almost no way to, it's so complicated, 2,000 years about arguing about calendars. I never thought this is important until I became a pastor. And if you don't have a good calendar, it means you have two groups wanting to use the hall at the same time. I came to understand why calendars are so important, but that's neither here nor there. It started in the very earliest church. The Jews have both a solar and a lunar calendar. The lunar calendar is much less precise. It needs to be recalibrated all the time to catch up to the solar calendar. But they have a lunar calendar. Most Jewish feasts are determined by the lunar calendar. Now, the Romans did a solar calendar pretty much, I think, exclusively. And in the earliest church, there were groups that wanted to celebrate Easter on the solar calendar date. In other words, Christmas is on a solar calendar date, December 25th, every year December 25th. The lunar calendar is completely out of sync with the solar calendar. And we followed the Jews' lead on this for major feasts, such as Easter. Because it was thought of as Passover. So we went with a lunar calendar. And strictly speaking, Easter is the first Sunday after the first full moon following the spring equinox. That's when the night and day are equal. And the Orthodox do the same thing, but they change the date according to the Jewish Passover, thinking that it is inappropriate to have the Christian Passover, which is what the holy days are, before the Jewish Passover. They require that the celebration of Easter happens after the Jewish Passover. So they have to recalibrate every once in a while. Add to that the problem of the Julian and the Gregorian calendar. The ancient Roman calendar was completely out of sync with the sun, and so Julius Caesar fixed it. But after 1,500 years, that was out of sync. And so Pope Gregory, you were right, Gregory the 13th in the 1500s, he fixed it again. And at that time, I think it would be like you woke up on, you went to bed on April 1st, and the next day would be April the 13th.
Wow.
So it's like all these dates disappeared. Yeah. And the English did not go with it for ages because they thought it was a papal plot to steal some of the days of your life. I mean, it was so controversial. Wow. And the Eastern Church didn't go with it either. So that adds to the confusion. So there are times when we celebrate together, and there are times when we don't celebrate it together. Does that explain everything?
I the Holy Father seems like he wants to be about unity then. So he's saying,
yes,
you give us the date and we're going to go along. What does that mean? And he's the Pope. Of course, he can do that.
Yeah.
It'd be kind of cool. Share the same Easter, right? The same Holy Saturday.
Well, I think it would. I have no problem with it because you see, you know, what do you mean? Well, we celebrate Easter at the same date every year. No, we don't.
Right.
I mean, you know, well, it's exactly, that's the day that it happened. What do you mean that's the day that it happened on? It's not. He was crucified, I think, on the 14th of Nisan in the solar or the lunar calendar of the Jews. Who knows when that was? I mean, no, we can get so literalist about things that we grieve the Holy Spirit. And I don't think it would be a bad thing to celebrate together. I'll be amazed if it happens. I just...
Really? What would impede it from happening?
The Orthodox.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Orthodox there are some Orthodox bishops and priests who, you know, just really love the whole body of Christ. And then there are some who don't even recognize us as valid. There's a lot of independence among Orthodox churches and episcopates. And there's real tension over the split, which happened so many years ago. And I think there are some people who, you know, and on both sides of the discussion, who don't want to make nice. I personally think it would be pleasing to God.
Father, for those who don't know, you know, maybe you can take us back. The year was, 1054 when the split took place? Explain what happened and how, as John Paul II calls us, two lungs breathing in one body, our Orthodox, and of course we have the Roman Catholic Church here. What happened that caused this division?
Well, it's really kind of hard to say because it started way before then, really. There was a huge schism in 800. I mean, this was not, I think it was in the 800s. This was not the first schism between East and West. This is the one that has been permanent for 1,000 years. And the whole thing kind of, well, it sort of, I think, starts when Constantine moved the capital of the empire from Rome to the new Rome, which became Constantinople and today is called Istanbul. That Rome had diminished in importance, and they just assumed that the Bishop of Rome would move with the Roman government, which had become Christianized, was becoming Christianized, and they said, "No, we're not moving." The Roman Church maintained some independence from the Roman government by refusing to move to Constantinople. You know, the Orthodox churches are really identified. And now, this is from my perspective as a Roman Catholic priest. But so many of them are identified with the nationality. You're Greek Orthodox, you're Russian Orthodox, you're Bulgarian Orthodox. People now try to talk about American Catholics or German Catholics, and we don't accept that. We're Catholics in America or Catholics in Germany. We're not a national church. We're a universal church.
Amen.
And this tension existed, that there were three patriarchates, Rome, Antioch, and Alexandria, and, you know, more than 400 years after Christ, the Eastern Roman capital, Constantinople, kind of insisted that it be recognized as a patriarchate along with Jerusalem. And that was kind of an innovation. And Constantinople became a city of maybe 500,000 to 1 million people. And Rome was a backwater that got down to about 25,000 people. Why should this little town in Italy be calling the shots for everyone else? Mm-hmm. And, you know, increasingly the patriarchs of Rome, the successors of Peter, kind of claimed more and more authority. And something that, this is gonna upset some people. It's always fun. The Pope, the election of the Pope was ratified by the Roman Emperor, and the appointment of the Roman Emperor was ratified by the Pope. This system continued until about 1910. 1910, that the election of St. Pius X happened simply because, I think it was around 1910, because the Austrian Emperor, who still had a veto, because the emperors had vetoes, and he claimed to be the successor of the Holy Roman Emperor, who was the successor of the Byzantine Emperor, he claimed a veto. And so the candidate who was about to be elected, I forget who it was vetoed. Wow. By the emperors. This was in 1910.
Oh my gosh.
And what do you mean that the governments had to do? Yes, and this is part of the tension of it. I don't know if that helps at all.
1054 came the split. Let's pray for that unity. I got to give Pope Francis credit for at least trying to take a step in that direction.
Yeah, I think it is something worth doing.
Hey, Father, thank you. Thanks for being here.
Always great to... I haven't confused everyone.
You're great. You're the best. That's Father Simon. Check him out on Father Simon Says. I'll be back.
This hour is sponsored by Creative Planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More information, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
In a lab study, 3-week-old female rats were exposed to medium or high durations of blue light every day until they hit puberty. The ones who had the most daily exposure experienced puberty the earliest. They also had lower levels of melatonin, the hormone that affects sleep, and inflammation and cell damage in their ovaries. In an interview, the lead study author said, in the coming years, as the place of mobile electronic devices in our lives will increase gradually, blue light exposure in childhood will also increase. We think that the use of mobile devices, known as the inevitable blue light source, should be prevented in the childhood age group, and we should limit the usage times.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, fascinating. Huh? That was Dr. Mary Gillis telling us about an experiment that was conducted on mice. And what happens when they're exposed to blue light? I was struck by not the fact it disturbs sleep, but how it causes early puberty problems. I mean, that's pretty bizarre. Look, we live in a totally different time. We really do. This generation, I know sociologists and psychologists and physicians are going to be looking back, and they're going to notice radical changes. And when I grew up, I'd get on my bike and run out and play with my buddies. We'd throw a football around or play baseball or do whatever, right? At the time, we didn't have 500 channels to choose from on a TV. Certainly didn't have a computer in my pocket called a cell phone, right? Didn't have all the technology or the apps like TikTok and things like that that are really attacking attention spans. A couple things here. I came across... two articles, for example. And I'll just give you the headlines from these. I want to talk about these. One, check out this. Why attention spans are shrinking. Now, is your attention spans shrinking? You know, gosh, I just can't focus anymore. Can't stay, you know, when I'm watching that documentary and I'm tuned out, or I just can't keep my, finish this newspaper article or whatever it is, right? Anyone who's used TikTok knows how your attention span may be shrinking. Everything in our world, from the rise of sedentary jobs, right, to video games, to sexual promiscuity, to pornography, to nonstop music, all that feeds on an appetite for instant pleasure, and it lowers attention spans. That's where we are right now. There was another story that came across my radar. This one said, too much screen time? But check this out. It says, baby boomers can't stop staring at their phones. Are you on withdrawal? I mean, do you ever like not have your phone with you? And you're like, oh my gosh, I don't have my phone. Well, what if you're in your car, you're already halfway to where you need to be? I got to go back and get my phone. When have you ever done that in the past, right? I mean, when have phones become, you know, a necessary appendage? I don't know. But they have. They really have. And here's the thing. Kids are addicted to their devices, and we know that. We know how it's changing the brain. But it's not just kids anymore. And this is one of the things I want to start with. We'll talk about children as well. Baby boomers, parents, they're dealing with this. So Washington Post did an informal survey, right? They took a look at people from the millennial and Gen X generations, I should say. They asked about their parents and their phone habits, which means, you know, we're talking about the baby boomers. And about half of them said their parents didn't have a phone or they were still using a flip phone, which might be a good thing, right? The other half said, though, that their parents were as addicted to their phones as kids were. And this showed up, for instance, for, you know, the younger generation bringing their children to visit their grandparents, let's say, and the grandparents stuck on their phones or they're ignoring their kids. Now, I don't have any grandkids yet, so I don't know what this is like. That's kind of unfortunate and even sad. You know, I had an Italian grandmother. She was old school. She'd be stirring marinara in the kitchen or making, you know, homemade pasta. I mean, she loved to show her love through food, I think, right? And everybody's grandmother might be a little bit different. Maybe your grandmother spoiled you with candy or something else, you know? To think that your grandmother is going to be on her cell phone ignoring you, I mean, that's just so weird. So according to the Washington Post, they're playing Words with Friends. They're playing Candy Crush. And they're playing card games. And all of it with the volume turned up. Why? Because they can't hear, right? So they're looking at the news. They're checking sports scores. They're scrolling Facebook and texting. Some are even using them as actual phones. One parent of the two kids told the Post this. They say, quote, phone calls are the worst. They'll take 45 minutes phone call with some random golf buddy. And I'm over with the kids just trying to visit them, the person says. So, of course, it's not just adults. It's also kids. There was a piece in the Institute of Family Studies that suggests that children ages 8 to 12 spend 5.5 hours a day on their screens. Teens, 13 to 18, they spend nearly 9 hours a day on their phones. I'm sorry. That cannot be healthy. It leads to all kinds of problems, including isolation, decreased social connection, and we see suicide rates and all these other things happening, anxiety and depression. I've invited Dr. Jean Twenge to stop by. She's a professor of psychology at San Diego State University and the author of the book, iGen. She's been with me many times here in the past. She's an expert on this. And I'd encourage you to check out her website, jeantwenge.com. Her last name is spelled T-W-E-N-G-E.com. If you're going through this, if you're seeing this, give us a call. Feel free to join the conversation. The number here is 888-914-9149. Doctor, welcome back. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you.
So let's start with the adults. All right. I find that striking. I'll do my own confession here. I mean, I'm addicted to my phone. I mean, if I'm leaving my house, my phone's got to be on me. I feel naked without it. It's like not having your wallet with you. You know, it's a way you can communicate. You know, and you got all sorts of other stuff, GPS in it if you need it. You've got even your banking information or cards. You can pay through your phone now. There's a lot of advantages to it. Does the fact that adults, including baby boomers, are becoming more addicted to their phones, does that surprise you at all? Did you think it was just going to be this younger demographic?
You know, it is a little surprising just because we usually, as you said, we associate grandma with, oh, the kids are here and I'm going to drop everything and have a conversation. I'm going to be in the kitchen making that marinara sauce. But the modern world marches on and this technology is designed to be addictive. And it is going to impact the kids the most because it's the only world that they have ever known. But a lot of people on Facebook are over the age of 60, and it draws them in, and the algorithms that it uses keeps people coming back, and that is true for older people just like it is for younger ones.
So what's causing this? I mean, why do phones? I mean, why does this little device in our pocket or our pocketbook, why does it hold such attraction for people? What is it about it that, I don't know, psychologically hooks the user?
That's interesting because you're absolutely right. Phones are extremely useful. You know, we want to take them with when we leave the house because what if we need to call AAA?
Right.
What if we get lost? Right. There's all these very practical things we can do on it. But that means it's always with us. And so the problem, the hard thing about phones is, okay, you're going to open it to look at your boarding pass or right. Read the news in a line. But then before you know it, you're picking that phone up whenever you have any kind of free moment. And that even sometimes can include in those social situations. So that's when it's the most insidious,
is when you're having a face-to-face conversation with one person or a group of people, then it's just so tempting. You get twitchy. You're so used to looking at your phone and especially looking at social media that you start to look at it. And that happens, if you probably notice this, when one person in the group grabs their phone, even if it's because they have to answer an emergency call or just, you know, look to see if their flight's going to be on time, then everybody else has the urge to go look at their phone too. And then it's all downhill from there.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah, if kids' parents are addicted to their phones, it makes me wonder how they're going to be able to say anything to their kids about the amount of time their kids are spending on the phone. So it seems like the whole family is dealing with this. What are the repercussions of this? Is it diminishing attention spans? Is it increasing anxiety and depression? Is there a link to this and suicide? I mean, I'm throwing a lot out there. You're the expert. What have you seen in your data?
And there's a lot of outcomes. So one is that situation where you are with people face to face and then the other person pulls out their phone. That's called fubbing. It's a new verb. And sure enough, you know, that has an impact on relationship satisfaction, particularly in marriages. Group of friends out to dinner. There's been a couple of very interesting experiments on this. When people have their phones available, then that dinner tends not to be as enjoyable. That's what people say.
Wow.
You know, they have that situation as opposed to, you know, everybody's phone is away. Then there's the huge implications, particularly for young people and for teenagers and for children, that at the same time that these devices became a standard piece of our lives, and especially as social media moved from optional to mandatory, adolescent mental health began to deteriorate. And these are not small changes. Things like clinical level depression doubling in just a 9-year period. And that's even before, that's before the pandemic. And we all know about all of the mental health issues around the pandemic. Nope, this is something that has been going on for about 10 years. It started to increase about 2011, 2012, and teen depression doubled. Self-harm behaviors like cutting have quadrupled among girls and young women. And yes, most tragic of all, the suicide rate has also doubled in these age groups over that same time period.
It's tragic, is really what it is. I mean, it's quite, as I said in the very beginning, I think we're going to see, you know, sociologists and psychiatrists and others in the future look back and they're going to see a real change in behavior and they're going to see the link to it. I just hope we do something to correct the problem before it's too late. Doctor, hold the thought. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about TikTok. I've been talking about it in terms of national security and other types of concerns that we have here in the country. But, you know, there are many experts that are saying this is the most detrimental thing that can happen to a young person's attention span. And we'll talk about why when we come back. You might think, Drew, I know you've been talking a lot about TikTok. Well, we've talked about, you know, the implications of it on a large scale. Wait to hear what it does to the mind. That coming right up.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Somehow it doesn't mean very much unless you've got someone to share it with.
This is the Drew Mariani Show, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. Coming up next.
Yeah, we're about 12 minutes away, so feel free to join me. It's always good to pray with you. We'll stop in a few minutes to do that. Right now, if you're just joining me, we're taking a look at shrinking attention spans. We're also taking a look at the rise of addictive behavior for Gen Xers, from baby boomers, in terms of their cell phones. And it is really infiltrating the family. And I go back to the spiritual always. I think, you know, I always look at the attack on the family. How can you divide the family, right? How can you separate them, break down conversation, increase anxiety and depression? I don't know. This seems like a pretty good tool. It seems to be doing that. I think we need to exercise some self-mastery and some governance and some discipline. Maybe for that Christmas dinner you're going to be having or next time everybody's over, say, hey, everybody, put your cell phones over here on this table, or hey, put them in this basket here. Grab them when you leave. Might be a good idea, right? As you heard my last guest, Gene Chuangi, she says, you know, people who have phones with them during these dinners, the experience is less enjoyable. But, you know, in terms of attention spans, just to put this in perspective, and I want to get her take on this. We'll take your calls. attention span is so essential for kids, right? That's why so many kids are on Adderall today, right? Before the first day of school, children with access to YouTube and other forms of social media, they've had their brains rewired. Math and science and composition are always going to be less interesting than online content specifically targeted to, let's say, those particular kids' preferences. And then social media keeps tweens and teens from experiencing the world, I think, in a more meaningful way, and it creates these shallow connections. Long attention spans brought humanity the work of Einstein, right, and Newton. What's the future look like? You know, China doesn't let their kids have access to TikTok. If they do, you know what's on their TikTok? It's like science experiments and ways that you can be a better citizen and things along those lines. America, it's poisoning their kids. We have to stop allowing this technology to change us and embrace deeper thinking. But TikTok is the most detrimental thing that can happen to the attention span. You have this endless cycle of bright colors and catchy sounds meant to be consumed faster than your brains can process the content, and is changing them. I've invited today my guest, Dr. Jean Twenge, to give us a perspective on this. She wrote a book called iGen, well worth the read. It's called Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and what that means for the rest of us. You can check her out at jeantwenge.com. Doctor, I'd love your take on TikTok, YouTube, early exposure, and what it means to attention spans and what that portends for the future.
It is really, really amazing to compare the version of TikTok that Chinese kids see versus the one that American kids see. So you're right. The Chinese version, they're seeing pandas and educational videos, and it's limited to 40 minutes a day. There is no limit on the amount of time that a child can use TikTok here. And there's supposed to be an age limit of 13, but that is not enforced. I collaborated with the Institute for Family Studies recently. Mm-hmm. We did a study of tweens and teens. And even among fifth and sixth graders, so we're talking 10, 11 years old, many of them, most of them, said that they use social media. And among those that use social media, a good amount of those specifically said their parents had not given them permission.
Wow.
And this was an anonymous survey, but still, I bet the numbers are really even higher than that. It was amazing to see how many kids 12 and under, who under the law are not supposed to use these apps at all, are using them, often without their parents' permission. And if you say, well, wow, wait, how can that happen? It's because that law is not enforced. That age limit of 13, there is no age verification.
Wow.
And there's no parental permission that is required. So I think this is in some ways the most disturbing piece, is that kids can get on social media off at the age of 9 or 10, get addicted to it, and their parents don't even know, because they can sign up for these accounts without permission and at these very, very young ages.
Wow. Let's do this. We'll take a few calls. I only have a few moments left with Dr. Twenge. If you want to join us, the number's 888-914-9149. You can call now and get in, share your experience, maybe your concern, maybe how you're dealing with all this. We'll go to Lexington, Kentucky first. Elias, doctor, is listening to us there. Hi, Elias.
Hello. I just want to have a comment and a question. I'm 71 years old. I do not carry a cell phone. I don't have TV. I have radio. I've been living like that for a long, long, long time. And I'm getting used to this lifestyle. I feel very, very peaceful. My question is, I think social media has a negative impact mentally, psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually on young people. And I think it's causing moral harm. I'm going to hang up and listen to the doctor.
Thank you very much, Elias.
Well, I have to agree. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why we need to take this so seriously and try to get more regulation, because I think it's very, very tempting in these cases to say, wait, where are the parents? It's the parents. Parents are supposed to step in. And yes, of course, we need to be there as parents. I have three kids myself, two of whom are teenagers. But I also know, partially from being a parent, just how difficult that is, and in some cases impossible, because our kids have school laptops. And even if you don't give them a cell phone, they
have ways to access these things, and they could be watching a kid-friendly movie, close it, and go start to open a social media account, and there's very little regulation in place to stop that. Plus, if your kid's the only one who doesn't have a smartphone or is the only one who doesn't have social media, you know what you're going to hear. I'm the only one, and I feel left out, and so on. We need these group-level solutions, not just individual ones.
Doctor, what can parents do? We only have a few minutes left. I'm curious as to what advice you would give to parents who say, I missed the boat. You know, I let my kids have it. They've got their cell phone and all these other digital devices. What advice you'd give to new parents as well as those who are dealing with this addictive behavior? And, you know, it's really, I think parents have got to do something because it will affect attention span. It will affect anxiety. It will affect all these other things you talked about. It affects the brain. So your advice, the way to maybe detox or safeguard oneself?
There are times and places for the phone, and then there's times and places where it does not belong. So my number one piece of advice is no phones in the bedroom overnight. That's not just for kids and teens. That's for adults of all ages as well. Great studies and lab studies and sleep labs. People do not sleep as well when their phone's there, even if it's on vibrate, even if it's off. You know it's there, and it can disturb sleep. And not looking at it before you go to bed, because that blue light shines into your eyes and tricks your brain into thinking it's daytime, then you don't produce the melatonin that you need. So stuff around sleep is one place to start. Then it can be no phones at the dinner table, and that has to be for adults because teens can smell hypocrisy miles away. So you have to do it yourself too. And just have times and places that are screen free.
Yeah, I love it. Well, Dr. Frizzell, thanks for your time. I'm grateful for it. I want to make sure I give your book a plug before we run out of it so people can check this out. If you want to read more and really get up to speed, check out iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood, and What That Means for the Rest of Us. Where can people get the book? What are they going to find in it?
So it's on Amazon and most major retailers. So it's about 10 trends that have shaped this generation born after 1995. Of course, technology's in there, but it's also things like they're taking longer to grow up, which is advantages and disadvantages. They are spending less time with their friends in person, and they're very focused on safety. So it's certainly not all bad. They are a really fascinating generation and very, very different from the millennials just before them.
Well, keep up your good work. Keep writing, okay? Keep sounding the alarm, and love to talk with you again. I'm sure we'll be doing that soon.
Thanks very much.
That's Dr. Jean Twenge, and you can check her out. She's a professor of psychology at San Diego State University, the author of that book, iGen. Her website, Jean Twenge, TWENGE.com. Hey, I only have a moment or two before we begin the chaplet. I do want to invite you to join me, and let's pray for our kids. You know, let's pray for this next generation. As I said when we began, we're in a different era. You know, our children face all sorts of new challenges, and as parents, I think it's harder. I do. There's always been threats, right, to your children. I think they face untold spiritual threats today, and I think there's technology, there are more powerful drugs. I mean, everywhere you turn, there are greater dangers. Let's pray for our children. Let's pray for peace in the world. We got a lot to get into today. Today's actually the anniversary of the apparitions of a vision where the Mother of God appeared in the jungles to a group of seers back in 1981. The visions ended in 89. I happened to be there for the very last apparition. And Our Lady prophesied a lot of what was going to take place in our own day and our age. And much of that has come true already in very vivid detail. Well, look at that. China is facing mass protests. This is unprecedented. I just saw a graphic, a map of protest all over China. We'll see how that shakes out. They're calling for Xi Jinping to step down. Plus, we'll talk with a Detroit TV personality, Chuck Gattaca. He actually had a radical conversion and has returned to the Catholic Church. That and a whole lot more coming up right after the chaplet.